You are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indian Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL Coco, 99.9 FM.
Friends, right here in sunny Coco, Florida, and I am wearing a yellow dress today to show my support for the Ukrainian people, and it's all about the sunflowers today. That's right. We are heard on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and my dear Ellen O'Neill is here, and she'll tell our listeners how to tune in on the World Wide Web.
Yeah, all over the world on 1510wwbc.com. You can either click that on-demand button and select by date, so you'll hear our archive shows, or you can just hit the Listen Live button and listen live just like we do. All of our archive shows are shared on our Facebook page, as well as cedamediainc.com, which is our website. And for the last 12 years, you figure 52 weeks a year, two guests a week, we got a lot of shows on there, a lot of fantastic people. And today is no different. You've, again, selected a lot of great, two great people to share some airwaves with today. And by the way, you look beautiful in yellow.
Yeah.
And I seem to remember that being your high school colors, like all of the ladies
yellow.
Were wearing yellow at
yes.
your high school reunion, right?
That's right, that's right.
Because you look beautiful.
Thank you, my friend. So our show today, we have two great guests who are calling in. The first one is Ms. Cheryl Needle Cone, Dr. Cheryl Needle Cone, and she will speak about how she became a Holocaust scholar, her books, and more. Cheryl studied at the prestigious International School for Holocaust Education at Yad Vashem in Israel. Dr. Cone's writings include the popular nonfiction book, The Boy in the Suitcase, Holocaust Family Stories of Survival, and it's available on Amazon. She's also a teacher. She's an academic support teacher at Lake County and proudly started the first ever K-5 After Tennis Club. She's going to be calling in a minute. And our second guest is with a gentleman, an attorney. His name is Mr. Thomas Mann Jr., and he is an attorney, a politician. He will speak about his books, Surveillance and Call to Serve. And Ellen, this the gentleman who is calling in the second half of the show, his bio is amazing.
Very
he was elected as a Democrat to the Iowa State Senate. He was the first ever African American to be elected in that body in November of 1992 and served 2 years in the Iowa Senate. And he also was an administrative hearing officer with the Texas Workforce Commission. I mean, his bio, he was an attorney with Man and Man Law Offices in Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa, from 1983 to 1992, specialized in employment-related litigation, inclusive of civil rights, unemployment compensation, and wrongful discharge. And boy, his books, Surveillance and Call to Serve, we're going to chat about that. Our show has become like Book Central now. Everybody wants to call in.
Well, because it's so, and you and I both know as authors, because we've both authored books, that how important it is to get your message out, and you think that you're going to be able to do it by a book alone, and then you realize that, you know, there needs to be other channels and other avenues to get the word out.
Right.
And, of course, people reading your book, you know, and loving your book, as we do with most of the authors that are on, that come on, we try and get at least excerpt in so that we understand where the writing was coming from, right?
Right.
So exciting.
And thank you for that. And so for our listeners who are just tuning in, Ellen O'Neill and myself, we sit here on Mondays. Our producer's Paul. We've been on air for 12 years. We've never really had a day where we didn't have a guest. That's amazing.
No, really.
And so we talk about kitchen table topics. We speak about things that are going on right here in the state of Florida. We speak about things that are going on internationally. And Samantha joins us sometimes in studio as well. But today, we our guest, Dr. Conan, is on the phone. We're going to talk to her in a minute.
Absolutely.
But I just wanted to say, before we go to Dr. Conan and talk about her books and, you know, being a Holocaust scholar, which is so fitting for a day like today, I just want to say that my prayers, my heartfelt prayers goes out for the people of Ukraine and for the brave leader who had a chance to leave and get out of harm's way with his family. But you know what he said? He's not leaving. He's not leaving. He is staying there with the citizens of Ukraine, and he's going to put up a good fight for his country, for what he believes in, and for freedom. And a lot of us talk about freedom, but would we really stand up the way he has? He is a real hero. You know, and so I'm wearing yellow today because I stand in solidarity with the people of Ukraine. And I think aggression anywhere in our universe is not good.
No.
Injustice is not good, right? We all speak about leaving a good footprint behind on this earth. And we talk about changing our behaviors towards each other so we could truly enjoy God's magnificent planet. And I hope that President Putin and all the other people will sit down and come to a resolution that helps that part of the world.
Absolutely.
And with that, we're going to go to Dr. Cheryl Needlecone, who holds degrees in education and psychology, by the way. And she's also an author and everything else. So thank you for taking the time to call in, Dr. Cheryl Needlecone.
Oh, thank you, Sita, for having me on your show. And what a wonderful segue opening with our referencing the Ukraine, which is under such pressure now, and where I travel to do a lot of the research for my book, The Boy in the Suitcase, Holocaust Family Stories and Survival. A little plug there. But as you know, that's my ancestral homeland as well.
Yeah, I was reading that and I'm like, you know what? Isn't it wonderful to have you call in and spend a few minutes of your time today on February 28, 2022 and speak with us? It's such an honor and a privilege to have you on.
Thank you.
So
thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. So tell us a little bit about yourself. And so you ended up studying in Israel. Was that something you planned or it just happened?
No, I hadn't planned it. I hadn't planned on being a Holocaust scholar at all, actually. I was just going about my business teaching. I was teaching at a college in New York, and I then moved to Florida, where I was hired by the University of Central Florida, and I teach currently at an elementary school. I'm an academic support, but never had I thought about the Holocaust as an area of research and study, and far from my thoughts was going to Israel, even though I am Jewish. It is the desire of most to go, Christians and Jews, to travel to Israel, but that wasn't on my radar at the time. My beloved grandma, Bella, was grandma and grandpa moved from New York to Brooklyn, New York. They were immigrants from the Russian territories in Eastern Europe. And they told me just a little bit about the family history. But grandpa passed away. Grandma, I would spend time with grandma. And she would tell me a little bit about her beloved village called Dubno, D-U-B-N-O. And she always called it Dubno, Russia, because that's when she was born, Dubno, the shtetl. Shtetl is Yiddish for village. The shtetl was in Russia. My great-grandfather actually taught, he was a teacher, he taught the children of King Osavska in the Russian territories, which then later became Poland. And so when I was visiting grandma, I get a little bit of stories. And then after grandma passed away and my sister and I were cleaning out her house, in the bottom of a closet was a corrugated box. And in the box were pictures. And I take out this big 8x10 picture, and well, larger than 8x10, and I see a family in clothing that looked like around pre-World War II, in what, you know, would be Russia. And there was only one person in the picture I recognized, and that was my great uncle Arthur, which was her youngest brother. And I said to my sister, Sue, these are family members that we have never met, know nothing about. Grandma didn't speak. I've got to investigate. This is a mystery. And so I viewed it as a mystery, not even thinking Holocaust yet. And so I did a little research. I started to do genealogy work. I looked where Dubno was and discovered that Dubno was in the Ukraine. And I said, how could this be? And so doing more history, going into online to the Ukrainian archives, I then discovered the truth about my family.
Amazing. That you took the time. You know, a lot of people will come across stuff and their families or grandmas will hand down a story. And for some reason, they don't follow up on it. But you've got a very curious mind. And I'm so grateful that you wanted to know more, because you went on to find out that there was a murder in the family as well?
Yes. So I decided that I needed to take a journey. And being a college professor, I had the privilege of being off in the summer. And so I booked a trip to Ukraine, and I flew into Kiev. And we now see what's happening in Kiev. May they continue to have the strength to fight. And so I landed in Kiev. I hired an armed driver. I hired an interpreter. And then when I got to the village of Dubno, I met, and I had pre-written a letter, a long, you know, a type of letter, a snail mail, not email, to the town historian and named Tamara. And so my journey in Ukraine began with driving with these, my entourage, and the reason I hired an armed driver, because I also was going to cross later into Belarus on another day for my grandfather's side. But so we drive across country, we drive across Ukraine, and we get to Lviv. Now, you've seen on the news, Lviv, that's where the government, some of the government members moved to Lviv, in the northwest of Ukraine, from Kiev, to be safe. This is what's going on now.
Yeah, you know, as you speak, I'm saying to myself, we're hearing about all these places in the news right now, Belarus, Kiev, everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So I hear that you were almost arrested twice.
Yes, thank you for asking about that. Now, let me point out to your listeners that when you have your passport taken away from you, you lose your identity. And one of the things I absolutely was not going to do under threat of arrest was give up my passport. So we drove across the country to Lviv, checked into the hotel, because then the next day we were going to drive to Dubno, which again, as I mentioned, was Russia, then Ukraine. In between, it was under Polish control, by the way. So we check in the hotel. The next day we go to check out, and they say, your credit card that you gave us does not work. And I said, how could this not work?
That's
said,
like a traveler's worst nightmare.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. This is a book in itself and a movie in itself. So we're in the lobby. And I say to the woman, oh, let me have my passport that's in your, because they take your passport, they put it in their mail slot. I said, can I have my passport? I think I have another credit card in there. I get my passport back. I literally am lunging across the desk to grab it. And then I realized my travel agent in America was a criminal. She thwarted me. And every time I used my card, she would then use the card and depleted my account. And so my American Express card. So now I'm in a hotel in a foreign country, and they, that now I realize They must have pushed a button under the desk. And I turned to look at my driver and my interpreter. They're on the phone with their people from the agency. And to their right are two armed guards, Ukrainian police, with Uzis. And so now I had to think fast. And so I remembered Off the Lobby was a travel agency. I called my sister in New York, and it was 3 a.m. in New York. And I said, Sue, I need your credit card immediately. I need you to give it to the hotel. I gave them the phone, and I just said to the woman and to the police, I'm just going next door to check on my flight reservation. And so I whispered to my armed driver and my interpreter, load the luggage in the car and meet me out back. And I swear to you, that's what happened. I jumped in the car and we drove. And we drove to the airport in Lviv, and I flew to Poland.
Wow. So, that's a scary thing to happen to someone, especially when you're so mm-hmm. far away from home. And thank God you at least knew some of the customs and the language. Can you imagine if that had happened in a place mm-hmm. where you couldn't mm-hmm. speak the language and everything was it's terrifying. Yes. So and then from there
the second arrest?
Yes, yes. So, Ellen,
I'm dying.
Ellen,
I always want
is
the
dying.
Drama.
Yeah.
Yes. So I went to Dubno and to the village while still in Ukraine before flying to Poland. And so I remember Grandma talking about the old marketplace, that before the Sabbath, before Friday night Sabbath, the people would come to the marketplace and sell their wares, their linen goods, the challah breads they'd make, etc. And so I said to my driver, let's go to the marketplace. We go to the marketplace, and Tamara had told me about the old Jewish cemetery. And so we walk past the marketplace to the Jewish cemetery, the old Jewish cemetery, which is not used anymore because it was destroyed. And there's a fence around it, protecting it. And I see there's a hole.
Oh, and no, so, you did not.
Oh, yes.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, I got to tell you, when I came back to America and told my family what happened, they were going to lock the doors and never let me travel again.
Do you feel like it was a spiritual awakening that you felt connected mm-hmm. to the people who came before you, your Jewish ancestors that were buried, that you had to pay respect to them and say, I'm here and I can feel you?
Exactly. And so, but beautifully said, Sita.
Thank you.
So, and Ellen, so I actually jumped through the hole in the fence. And behind me, I have Tamara yelling in Ukrainian. I've got my interpreter yelling in Russian and the driver yelling in Belarus. And they're all yelling in Belarusian, and they're all yelling at me, no, you cannot go there. That it is protected by police and whatever, you're not allowed there. And I turn, and in English I say to them, I did not travel all this distance not to see and bless my ancestors. And so I go down the hill, and it's like an old movie, like I don't know, like a Godfather movie, because my entourage is now chasing me down the hill.
We're just imagining the scene, an American in Ukraine breaking into a cemetery to get connected to her spiritual side. But you know what? That led to you becoming mm-hmm. a scholar in what you're doing now about the Holocaust, because those people were talking to you. So everything happens for a reason, right?
Yes. And then I actually fell into a ravine and realized... Oh yes, and so the driver and the interpreter are pulling me under each arm out of the ravine, about 2 feet drop, and then I realized that I was standing on the ashes of my relatives, because they had, before the very first death camp was even built in Auschwitz and et cetera by the Nazis, they were coming into the villages and killing the Jews, and what are called Einsatzgruppen. Nazi roving troops of Nazis, and they came into my grandmother's village Grandma had already emigrated to America, and she got one brother out, but the rest of the family were lined up at the ditch area in the cemetery. They had to dig their own ditch, and they were shot.
So they were shot right where you fell?
Yes.
Well,
their ashes were under my feet.
Wow.
Yes.
See, and that's like divine intervention for me.
Yeah.
Like that you trip right in that one spot, in that spot.
Yeah.
There.
Yes. Yes.
Well, they were calling you. I say they were calling you. They wanted you bust through that hole in the barbed wire and come and find them because they wanted you to tell their story. And so, so this is where the boy in the suitcase came from. All of this is part of that.
So I'll tell you, with Israel, I had been accepted. I was invited to come to Israel to study the Holocaust at Yad Vashem, which I accepted.
I bet they loved that story that you told, and I know you told them that story.
They did. And so I came back to America, and here's where the boy in the suitcase comes in. I continued my teaching at UCF. I supervised student teachers, and I had a seminar. I decided I needed to teach, for social studies education, I needed to teach about the Holocaust so that when my student teachers graduate and go into their classrooms, they are learned about the Holocaust. And so I did a presentation to college students, and afterwards, a young woman comes up to me and says, I was born in the Dominican Republic. My sister went to school in Sosua, Dominican Republic, with Jewish children from Holocaust survivors. I said, Dominican Republic?
Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing, right? Because who would think?
Right. But the dictator, Trujillo, decided, even though he was murdering his dissidents and he was murdering Haitians, he decided that he would give visas in Germany and Austria to people trying to flee from the Nazis. And so he did. And you have to read the chapter in the book to understand why he did it.
Yeah.
But so a group of survivors came to Sosua, Dominican Republic, and created a community there. And so I go where the stories are. That's why there's 9 family stories in my book. Each chapter is a different family story throughout the world. And each of those chapters, I lived in those countries every summer for 6 years. I would come back. I did pre-interviews, post-interviews, did the research in the countries, would come back and write, lock myself in the house and just write from dawn to dusk. And it grew up to be the book, The Boy in the Suitcase, Holocaust Family Stories. And the Dominican Republic story became, my editor said, that needs to be the title of the book, that story. And so hence the baby who was smuggled out of Germany and in a suitcase and raised in the Dominican Republic.
Wow, what a fantastic story. So let's move, change gears just a little bit here. Now we hear you've got some screenplays started, which is so exciting. And before we go on, for our listeners who might be authors out there and maybe thinking about writing a screenplay, what's the difference between writing a book and writing a screenplay for you? What's your creative process?
Yeah. So, as you know, there are 2 types of books. There's fiction, well, more than 2, and nonfiction. Mine is nonfiction. And there's the true stories. And you write in a narrative that's going to tell the information, but you also give a lot of research to back up. You have to support what you're writing. If you write a screenplay, it tends to be what's called historical fiction. So it's based on history, but I hate to say this, but my editor said, Cheryl, you need to sex up your stories. And I said to her, how do you make the Holocaust sexy? I said, it's a horrible time. My family was murdered.
Yeah.
But what she meant was fictionalize some of the story to make it more interesting, to make it a bigger visual.
To make it human. And, to make it human.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like it could be a boy and a girl who were in love, who was standing at that ditch when they were killed.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the Belgium story has a love story in the screenplay version. The Belgium story tells of a baker who was part of the Belgian Resistance and hid infants in her bakery attic. Nuns would come at night and give them to safe houses. And so the Pope was involved, the Queen was involved, the churches and local people fighting the Nazis in Belgium. And that grew up to be, that story is in the book called The Baker of Carignan. Carignan spelt with a Q. And so I took the nonfiction story, made it into a screenplay, and so The Baker of Carignan is available from my entertainment attorney, as well as me, and it's a full-length feature film screenplay that we are still trying to get a producer to produce.
And you know something? Sita is so connected. She knows people in Hollywood. She knows people that have done documentaries. So just by listening to the show, y'all, if you are a screenwriter or producer out there, you might want to get in touch with Sita.
So for our listeners who are tuning in today, we're speaking with Dr. Cheryl Needle Cohn, and she holds degrees in education and psychology. She's also a well-known Holocaust scholar. And I could just picture you writing a screenplay about that scene in the marketplace. Everyone loves to go to the marketplaces in other countries because that's where that's the life of that place, no matter where you are, the marketplace, right? So, you know what? When I speak to you, I think, like, now I could see where President Zelensky got his chutzpah from. You know, you are courageous. You are brilliant. You make great decisions based on the fact that you ran into that cemetery with everybody saying no. And then you came out of it and you became a scholar, went to Israel, wrote this book. Mm-hmm. And you're sharing the stories and bringing this Holocaust, the memory of it, the history of it, and what happened to people, how unfortunate it was that so many people died. You're bringing that alive so that we could remember that culture. So tell us where we can find your book, The Boy in the Suitcase.
Like everything, you can find it on Amazon. My publisher is Roman and Littlefield, so you can get it from the publisher's site. But it's just so easy to go on Amazon and type in The Boy in the Suitcase, Holocaust Family Stories of Survival.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Cheryl Needle Cohn, and we'll make sure that we share all of your information on our Facebook pages as well as our website so people can find your books and also your screenplay when those come out. But we got to take a quick commercial break to listen to our sponsors. Please tune in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right after these messages.
Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. Delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at cloud9furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud 9. Mattress and Furniture. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 13 locations, including one in Volusia County. With so many MedFast Urgent Care centers, there is a MedFast near you. MedFast offers top quality care that is close by, and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great tasting seafood, char grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000 or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We are on AM 1510. Our dial is WWBC. We're on FM 94.7, 99.9, FM 100.7. And we are heard on the World Wide Web. So people can tune in and listen to Mr. Thomas Mann today, Ellen.
That's right.
All live over the world, and get a copy of his book when we're done.
That's right. 1510 WWBC. You'll see the on-demand button. Those are the dates for our shows. So those are the archive shows. Or you can just hit the listen live button, and you'll hear us live just like you are now on your radio.
Right. And so our first guest, Dr. Cheryl Needle-Cohen, did a really great job chatting with us about Ukraine, the Holocaust. She took us back in Eastern Europe, didn't she?
What a cool adventure story that
it was.
And then it was for what she wrote about it and the fact that it's becoming a screenplay. I'm very excited.
And our second guest, as you know, is Mr. Thomas Mann, and he's written a book called Surveillance. And I already like his main character. His name is Jeff. And he also wrote a book. He wrote another one called Call to Serve. And Mr. Mann, I have to say, you are a dedicated human being on this planet that has used your career to fight for civil rights. You were the executive director of the Civil Rights Commission and the first African-American state senator in Iowa. And also, you're a retired attorney, and your bio is so extensive that Ellen and I were just saying it'll take the entire show to speak about you. I mean, you were appointed by Attorney General Richard Turner as an assistant attorney general in the state of Iowa. You were appointed by General Tom Miller as an assistant attorney general in the state of Iowa in 1980 to 1982.
Chair of the Ethics Committee.
Stuff. So talk to us. Tell us about yourself, Mr. Thomas Mann. What drives you? Where do you get all this energy to do all this stuff?
I grew up in Tennessee. I lived on the farm for about the first 16, 17 years of my life. Left the farm and went off to Tennessee State to study. Left Tennessee State and went to Iowa to study law at the University of Iowa. And I was fortunate enough to become a lawyer and work as an assistant attorney general in Iowa under two different attorneys generals. I worked for Richard Turner, a Republican, and for Thomas Miller, a Democrat. I learned a lot working as an assistant attorney general, but chose a different path. I got appointed by Governor Robert Ray as the executive director of the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, and that's where I chose to devote my energies and spent most of my life fighting for civil rights.
Yeah, and you know, when I read your bio, I was thinking about all the people right now who are fighting so that we can all have the right to vote. And I thought about redistricting and how disenfranchised so many people are. And the civil rights attorneys such as yourself, God bless them for making an effort to do what's right, because an injustice anywhere is not good for our country or for our world. So I thought about you, and I could just see you in front of me. I looked at your picture on the web, and I could see the young man that you were fighting for civil rights and interviewing clients and witnesses and determining your case and moving forward and just fighting for people not to be discriminated against. And I just wanted to say we owe you and people like you so much gratitude, Mr. Mann.
I committed my life to this effort, not because I might eventually obtain the gratitude of people in the community, but because I thought that there were wrongs in the community that needed to be fixed. When I grew up on the farm, my grandfather would hitch up the mules, and we would go get in the wagon and go to the city, Brownsville, Tennessee, and I would see the signs, blacks only, whites only, and it had an impact on me. I wanted to make a change, so I committed my life to bringing about that change to the extent that I could.
So tell us a little bit about, you were like a share, your family farmers, they were sharecroppers, right?
That is correct.
Go ahead.
We sharecrop, we raise cotton and corn and peas and farm products of that nature. We did not own the land. We lived on the land and we shared the expenses with the owner of the land. We would receive approximately one half or one third of the proceeds from farming, to the extent that there were proceeds. When I was growing up, there wasn't much in terms of proceeds, but we would get our third or our half, and we would live on that for the remainder of the year, and the next year would start all over again.
So there, wow. So there you were in the late 60s. I'm sure your family didn't have a college fund for you if you were sharecroppers. Did they have a college fund? See, even sharecropping, and even
not.
When you're on a third budget.
No, he said
budget.
They did not. He said, So were your relatives worried about you running into white people when you were running errands out of the farm? Because I would think that would be worrisome for your parents and family back then.
It was worrying. When I grew up, as you indicated, somewhere around the 50s and the 60s, 1950s. And that was a time shortly after Emmett Till had been killed, lynched, and others. And my grandmother was very much aware of that. And she would tell us, if I send you to the store, and she would send us to the store, we would have to walk. And she would say that, if you see a white person, don't look them in the eye. Go to the other side of the road. Don't say anything that's rude or could be interpreted as being rude. If it's a white woman, definitely do not say anything that could cause concern. So my grandmother was very much aware of that. And she schooled us on that and told us, just be real careful when you come upon white people.
So what you're describing is your experience, basically, growing up in the South during the Jim Crow era.
That is correct. It was the Jim Crow era, and things had not changed significantly. They have in the last 50 years. There has been changes, but back then, it was a very difficult time for black people, and we had to learn to live with it. My grandfather on one occasion, got upset about the land. We were out chopping cotton and so forth. And my grandfather got upset and started challenging the landowner and cursing back and forth. This really worried us. My grandfather could curse and would curse, but usually at home. But on this occasion, he directed his venom towards the landowner, who was white. And we were concerned about that for weeks afterwards.
Wow.
Nothing happened to him, but it was a dangerous time.
Yeah, so I would think that there must have been quite a discussion in your home, Mr. Thomas Mann, when you decided you wanted to go to college and law school. I can just imagine the family sitting at the farm, and there you were, this brave young man that says, I want to make a difference socially and politically, even though I know I have all these odds against me due to the color of my skin, and I want to be a lawyer. Tell us, take us back to that conversation.
As I recall, a pretty good time for me. I went off to college at Tennessee State first and earned my undergraduate degree before going to law school. And when I got ready to go to law school, my family was pretty supportive. My uncle, Booker T. Macklin, loaned me the money to fix up my cousin's car. We had to put a motor in it. And we did that. My brother and my cousin put a motor in it. And then we got in it. My brother and I drove to Iowa City. And we drove from Tennessee to Iowa. Iowa had a black population of around 2% and a total minority population of around 4%. So when we left Tennessee and drove through Missouri and into Iowa, we were concerned because there were a lot of white faces and we were not totally used to them. It was a concerning thing, but people treated us nice on that trip, and Iowans treated me nice, so it worked out okay.
Well, your story is very inspiring. I'm telling you, you just rose through the ranks, Mr. Thomas Mann. And you went to law school, and you also decided to become a politician. When did that happen? After you became an attorney, what drove you to become a politician?
I always wanted to be in politics. When I was growing up on the farm, I looked around and saw that the decision makers, the people who were deciding my fate and my family's fate, were lawyers, and the lawyers were politicians. So I wanted to be a lawyer, and I wanted to be in politics. And the first chance I got to be a lawyer, I took it. And the first chance that I got to be in politics, I took it. So in 1982 or thereabouts, an opening became available in the Iowa State Senate, and I decided to run. No black had ever served in the Iowa State Senate. So it was a tough choice to make, living in a state with a minority population of less than 4%, but I decided to do it anyway. I ran and I lost the first race, but decided that I was not going to be the example that people would use in perpetuity to prevent other blacks from running for public office. So I ran again, and in 1982, I won, becoming the first black to serve in the Iowa Senate.
Were there any laws in particular that you said these are the things, whether the laws were spoken or unspoken, that you said to yourself, this is something I want to change? Was there things happening around you that you said these things have? Because we see things happening right now, and a lot of us talk about it, but people don't take any action. So was there something that you saw that you said, I'm going to change this?
Well, the thing that stood out to me initially was the sign, the blacks only sign and the whites only signs from when I grew up. That penetrated my mind, and then that atmosphere I wanted to change. In 1964, before I became a part of the Iowa Senate, Lyndon Johnson, as president of the United States, helped get the Civil Rights Act passed, and so those signs came down. But there were a lot of other things that needed to be changed. Lyndon Johnson thought that you can't always change people's hearts, but you can change their actions. And I wanted to pass laws that would cause people to act differently, whether it be in public accommodations or housing or employment. And I worked on all of those areas when I was at the Civil Rights Commission and when I was in the Senate. I didn't limit myself to civil rights issues in the Senate. I worked on a broad spectrum of issues as vice chair of the Judiciary Committee, as chair of the Ethics Committee, as chair of the Labor Committee, and as president pro tem of the Senate. So I didn't limit myself. I tried to make a major contribution.
Yeah, and you have made a difference. You motivate so many of us. You know, if all of us change our behaviors on this earthly journey that we call life, what a great world we would have. I mean, we all learn from history. We learn from each other. We learn from listening and reasoning and understanding. And I'm so grateful for people like you and people before you that says, you know, the color of our skin should not determine who we are or where we're going. People should just stop and think for a moment. We're all God's children. You cut our skin, it's all red, the same red blood, right? So let's transition a little bit. So you retired, and then you wrote this book, Surveillance. It's about a lawyer who believes he's under surveillance, but he does not know who's watching him. Is any of this true? Tell us. We have like 10 minutes left, so we want to get into your book. And what made you write the book?
I wrote that book out of my experiences as a lawyer. I set the book in a Texas setting, but those experiences happened in Iowa. I was trying a case in an Iowa particular city that I had named, but while I was trying that case, I thought I was being surveilled, and I laid out in that book the things that caused me to believe that someone was watching. So it's sort of a gripping story, but that story is essentially a true story.
Wow. That's what I thought. I said, your character sounds like you know him.
I know him well.
Yes. So when you were writing the book, did you have to stop and think for a moment and say, well, you know, certain characters, they come alive, certain events, they're created and they're there in your mind. Did you have to stop and say, well, wow, we've come a long way in this country from what you had seen as a civil rights attorney? I mean, today we're so proud that President Joe Biden has selected Ketanji Brown Jackson to be the nominee for the Supreme Court, the next Supreme Court Justice, which I hope she gets confirmed. But when you were writing, did you compare events of the past to what's happening now in America?
Yes, I think that was sort of what propelled me forward in the writing. In terms of the specific writing, I had my own research. I had my notes for specific points, but I had in the back of my mind things that had happened in the past as a basis for moving forward and putting it down on paper. And so those things did inspire me. My past experiences did inspire me, and they were the things that helped me to decide what to do in that book.
Yeah, because we've come a long way, but we could do better. I mean, you're right. When I've read about the signs that says whites only or blacks only, and of course, I was born and raised in the Caribbean, and we read a lot about India, and when the British was there, and it would say no coolies allowed, or, you know, the British only. And it's the same kind of concept where one race of people felt they were superior to others based on the color of their skin. And it always bothered me as a child. And I always questioned, why would God make all of us but have people on earth be treated so differently because of the color of their skin? So I do feel like we've come a long way. And you certainly echo that in my thinking. So how long did it take you to write this book?
The surveillance book, I think I started somewhere around 2016 or 17 after I retired from my public service. And I think I published it in 2018 or thereabouts. And so it took me a couple of years to get my thoughts together and to put them on paper and to come to conclusions about what had happened. And that same process was followed with respect to the call to serve. So I would say about 2 years for each book.
So do you find that your family are supportive now that you've decided to write? Because it's inspiring to have people like you that says still have the memories and to write and tell us the stories, but in a different way, of things that you saw, things that happened, the events that you had to deal with as an attorney.
My family has always been supportive. I've always appreciated that it sustained me. When I was going to school, I'd come home, I would go to Brownsville, Tennessee, for example, and my aunt Lou Carey would assist me by motivating me and cleaning my clothes. She worked in a laundry. One way or another, family would be there for me, assisting me and supporting me and helping me. And I have found that to be true throughout my life. And that's been very helpful to me.
Well, you know, we've always said on our show, as long as you have friends, you have trusted friends, family, food, faith, and a little finances, you're good, Mr. Man. And so now, we're all watching in our country what's going on with the banning of books, and we see people who are saying they want to burn books and all that. Did you have a favorite childhood book that you enjoyed?
I read lots of books. I encourage kids to read because I think it expands the horizons. I read all of the favorites, Alice in Wonderland, and other books of that nature when I was a kid. And my family would complain that you're always back in that room reading. What's wrong with you? Well, it turned out to be a pretty good move on my part because it encouraged me to explore other avenues. Farming was not exactly the path that I wanted to follow. It's all right for those who want to follow it, but it wasn't something that I wanted to do. And books opened up a new world to me that I wanted to explore, so I went out and I explored it.
That's one of the reasons why we have a lot of authors that call in on our show on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, because we also encourage people to read and open their minds. So, Mr. Mann, we have 2 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, what was the most difficult part of this artistic process of writing your book?
I had notes, so that happened. I guess putting it together, I was fortunate enough to have access to editorial help in the early stages of the writing, and I think that was hard. I could get my ideas together without help, and I had notes to support that, but putting it in the proper order and expressing it in a way that people could understand it was something that I needed help with. And I had editorial assistance early on that enabled me to write the 2 books.
Yeah. And your book, Surveillance, is a story about a lawyer who believes he's under surveillance but does not know who's watching him. We have 1 minute left. How did you select the names for your main characters in that book?
My cousin, Jeffrey Curry. I used his name. I appropriated his name with his consent.
Yes.
As a main character in that book, because he had been with me on occasions when I believed that I was under surveillance, and we had discussed it. So I used his name as a character in that book.
Well, we will all have to get a hold of that book, and we'll make sure that we share that on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
And we'll also talk about the call to serve. So give us your website if you want people to get these books. Are they on Amazon or anywhere else?
They're on Amazon.com. Thomas Mann Jr. at Amazon.com. Both books are there and can be accessed there. Literally.
And we will make sure that we share all of that information. Now we are out of time, unfortunately, but thank you all so much for tuning in to listen to our great friends. I'm Thomas Mann, and for Dr. Cheryl Needle Cohn for her books. And we'll be back next week right here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends here at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on 1510 WWBC.